I never thought I'd live to be 100. I never thought I'd get to do the things that all those other sons do.
Welcome to the Gala 300th edition of It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. And Ron, happy 300th.
Happy 300 to you. Ken, you don't look a day over 200.
And Herman Cain doesn't look a day over 999. We have like over 100 great tributes that the listener has sent in.
The listener has been very busy typing furiously to get up to 100 emails.
And making up different email addresses because there's only one listener.
That's correct. And sometimes this listener claims to be in Tanzania.
We have some from Tanzania. We have some from China.
China. That's very interesting. And we'll tell you a little later on in the podcast, what was the one podcast out of 300 that the Chinese government saw fit to block?
We'll talk about that too. But first, the news of the week. And I think the news of the week is
pretty much money.
Here's the story. Joe Ricketts, the multi-billionaire.
How many is a multi, by the way? We talk a lot about multi-platform, multi-billion.
There's Uncle Multi.
All right.
In the 50s.
There's Uncle Multi. Right? Uncle Multi, yes.
But he also owns the Chicago Cubs, and we know how well that's done.
Tremendous success story.
Exactly.
Unbroken series of World Series that have not featured the Chicago Cubs.
Well, the New York Times has reported on Thursday morning that Mr. Ricketts and some other conservatives are plotting this new anti-Obama strategy.
Now, this is a proposal.
Right.
No one has actually put any of this on the air, and Mr. Ricketts has not bought the proposal, as we understand it. It's just a proposal to man who has a lot of money, and we do know has a particular political philosophy. We're going to talk a little bit about where some of his money may have affected a Senate race this week in a moment.
But as you say, we don't know if it's going beyond the planning stages. But and of course, with all this publicity, it may disappear completely. But the fact is, there's some serious conservative folks who are talking about using an issue that John McCain refused to use in 2008. And that is going after President Obama on his relationships with folks like Jeremiah Wright.
All right. A lot of people think of Jeremiah Wright as an old story. It was 2008. It was March. It was April. It caused President Obama, then candidate Senator Obama, to give his famous speech on race in March of 2008. And because Jeremiah Wright was controversial not only on international issues, you know, the United States' role in the world, war on terror, and so on, that he gave those fiery sermons about, but also on race in general. And a lot of people thought, well, this is going to raise race in such a way that it's going to end the Barack Obama phenomenon. In the end, that didn't happen. Jeremiah Wright came back a little later, had a press conference in Washington that, you know, kind of blew up at the end. A lot of people thought that was going to be really bad for the Obama campaign. Again, you know, fighting Hillary Clinton in those closing weeks. Then Jeremiah Wright seemed to have gone away. Or did he? What's he been doing the last 4 years?
Well, I think the reason he went away in 2008 is because the American people had other things on their mind, like the never-ending wars, the faltering economy, the near collapse of the economic system, shall we say.
But we should say that those wars, of course, have since completely ended. We've healed all the wounds in the Middle East, and the economy has bounced right back.
We're out of Guantanamo, and
All those prisoners were sent back to their native countries.
One reason we stopped hearing about Jeremiah Wright in the middle of the campaign is, one, the McCain campaign didn't want to employ those tactics, but more importantly,
they didn't want to exploit the racial.
Well, they did, and that was not McCain's kind of style. But we don't know for sure if this Jeremiah Wright campaign will happen, but we do know that there's a campaign going on right now with ads from both sides, and I think part of the conversation of this week was Mitt Romney's stewardship and tenure at Bain Capital.
Bain Capital was the majority owner. They were responsible. Mitt Romney was deeply involved in the influence that he exercised over these companies.
They made as much money off it as they could, and they closed it down. They filed for bankruptcy without any concern for the families or the communities.
It was like a vampire. It came in and sucked the life out of us.
It was like watching an old friend bleed to death.
This ad comes from the Obama campaign and is trying to rip apart, basically, the Romney argument for his own candidacy, which is stewardship and understanding of the economy. The Obama campaign, by focusing on Bain Capital, talk about what Bain did to small companies. And that's a message you're going to hear from the Obama campaign all year.
That's right. They want to run against the heartless businessman, Mitt Romney, and the heartless business practices of Wall Street, or fill in the blank. for the villain. Meanwhile, Romney, of course, has a pretty made-to-order script because the economy seems to be sputtering again, even after another, say, winter of several months of good job growth. The stock market was picking up. There seemed to be a lot of better news coming out of what has been a rather stumbling recovery, a weak recovery.
Gasoline prices were down?
Gasoline prices were down, finally. And then, of course, and part of the reason gasoline prices are down, is we started experiencing another crisis in the global capital markets, largely driven by the problems of Europe, the problems of Greece, but the problems of the other countries in Europe that have not been doing so well, Spain, Italy, Ireland, all of this debt that's piled up there. And that is a narrative that plays very well for Mitt Romney because he can link our economic troubles to our federal debt, which has expanded dramatically in the last several years under Barack Obama. And that is basically his economic argument.
And of course, there's a response from the Romney campaign. Here's their latest ad.
And it's hard to know where to put your trust. It's going to get tougher, I think.
That's the problem. A lot of people around here, when Barack, you know, was running and all that, everyone believed, everyone had hope. They all thought, man, this guy's going to get something done. When he is in office, now it just seems like nothing's getting done. It seems like it's all talk.
So we're going to hear a lot about this. We're going to hear it all summer. We're going to hear it all fall, back and forth between the sorrows of the American economy, blaming that on President Obama, and the sorrows of certain micro parts of the economy, which the Obama campaain will be blaming on Bain Capital. And whether Mitt Romney was there at that particular moment or not, Bain Capital and Mitt Romney will be seen as more or less synonymous in those ads. So we've got a program ahead of us. We can sort of watch this if we want to watch it, or we can sort of pick it up as it goes along.
Here's something that's not as easy to watch, and that's what's going on with the Ron Paul campaign. There was a headline out this week that he's suspending his campaign.
Not going to campaign in any states where they're still going to have a primary or a caucus. Wouldn't want to go there.
Exactly right. And the reason, first of all, and so the media defined that as he's suspending his campaign.
Quitting.
He's quitting, but he's not doing that at all.
Not at all.
What he's doing is, yes, he's not going to campaign in the 11 states still choosing.
Including Texas and California.
Exactly, because he knows he's not going to get the nomination. But what he is doing is his supporters are attending state conventions where delegates are named. So even though, for example, in Nevada, which Mitt Romney won overwhelmingly in the February caucuses, got over 50% of the vote, last week in the state convention, Ron Paul got 22 out of the 25 at-large delegates.
Now, by getting them, we should emphasize, they will still have to vote according to the results of their event.
And they say, during the first round, during the first ballot of the convention
That's
in Tampa,
right.
We certainly expect a second round.
Well, they are at least convincing themselves there will be a second round, which there won't. There hasn't been one.
Since 1948.
That's correct.
Thomas Dewey won the second round.
As he stormed to the presidency. But
and his two brothers.
Huey and Louie.
That's right.
Would you like to touch the bases? It is the 300th podcast. Where there is a 400th podcast, we will have to do that joke. So those people will go to the convention, and that's great. They'll have a wonderful time in Tampa. Maybe they'll abstain on the first ballot and wait for that second ballot to happen. But unless they can start doing this in some states more populous than Nevada and Maine, this is not going to lead to a sudden uprising and a Ron Paul nomination.
Perhaps not, but it could mean a different Republican Party in 2014 and perhaps 2016, because they've just elected the new chair of the Alaska Republican Party is a Ron Paul supporter. This weekend there's a Minnesota state convention where Ron Paul people are supposed to expect it to pack the convention. So perhaps it's not about 2012 at all. It's about the future of the Republican Party. And for all our talk, everybody's talking about the Tea Party and the control of the party. Ron Paul's folks are doing this under the radar. In other words, the success will not be measured by what happens in Tampa.
That I do agree with.
There was a lot of money poured in this week's Nebraska Senate primary. This is for the seat that Ben Nelson is relinquishing.
And Ben Nelson was a nominal Democrat.
A nominal Democrat. And the Democratic nominee will be Bob Kerry, the former governor and senator.
Who is a nominal Nebraskan.
Who gets a lot of money. It's hard to campaign from his apartment in Greenwich Village.
Listen, a lot of people have campaigned from their apartments in Greenwich
Village. Not in Nebraska.
Just not for the Nebraska Senate. Not for the Nebraska Senate seat.
And on the Republican side, the favorite from the beginning was John Bruning, the state attorney general.
He was my favorite.
He was running against Don Stenberg.
Oh, yeah. That was a tough choice. Now that you mention it, Don Stenberg was also a juggernaut. Formidable.
He was. Well, he has run for the Senate 3 times, but he was backed by the Club for Growth. He was backed by Jim DeMint. He was backed by this ad campaign that basically trashed John Bruning for being an unreliable conservative with ethics problems, with all these problems that he would not suit the Republican Party in the fall.
That was the formula right there, what you just described. That was the formula in Indiana that boosted Richard Murdoch over Richard Lugar.
But a better example might be Illinois in 1992 when Alan Dixon was being challenged by another candidate with negative campaigns. A third candidate benefited.
Carol Moseley Braun.
Back then it was Carol Moseley Braun.
Yeah. Now, but you're talking about Democratic politics and left politics in 1992 in Illinois. Now you're talking about conservative politics in 2012 in Nebraska, arguably one of our more conservative states.
Absolutely. But the winner, interestingly enough, was a state senator by the name of Deb Fischer. I'll be honest with you, 2-3 weeks ago, I had not heard of her at all.
A state legislator from, I believe, the largest geographical district in the state legislature in Nebraska. It's a unicameral, nonpartisan legislature, although she is a Republican.
I mean, I'd walk a mile for a unicameral.
And she represents the largest chunk of Nebraska in terms of geographical area, which means sparsely populated.
Right, exactly. Western.
And
away from Lincoln and Omaha.
That's right, away from the big metropolis. Out where the buffalo roam.
You know where the buffalo roam is, where we celebrate the bicentennial. Believe me, when the 400th podcast comes in, they're going to remember that joke.
They will remember. They will remember the bicentennial.
So anyway, Deb Fischer wins the primary, and even though she may be the most moderate of the three, it just shows that all this money coming to Nebraska basically backfired on the folks who wanted Stenberg, and they got rid of John Bruning, but they got Deb Fischer, who may not be a bad candidate anyway, but we have no idea.
She may be a great candidate. She may be a great senator. She may also wind up pleasing the Tea Party and the Club for Growth and all of those folks, so they don't really have any reason to feel that they have failed. And as you say, they succeeded in their prime mission, which was knocking off the establishment Republican Bruning.
You know, there's some other news of the week. I mean, yes, we do know that the John Edwards trial is going on, and yes, we know that Kate wasn't called and Riel Hunter wasn't called.
And John Edwards
And John Edwards was not called.
Supposedly the best lawyer in the room and the guy who knows how to influence a jury, and they didn't put him on the stand. What does that tell you, counselor?
Well, I think what it tells... Well, are we talking about Camp Lokanda? A different counselor.
We made an agreement early on we would never talk about Camp Lokanda.
Because if you know, if Rosemary DeCamp married William Kunstler, her name would be Rosemary DeCamp Kunstler.
All right. Which, of course, brings us to my personal favorite of all of your inane jokes.
What's in a name?
Over the years. Which had to be, if Nora Rahm married Rahm Emanuel.
That's right.
Her name would be
Nora Emanuel.
I don't know why. I tried telling that joke to any number of people, and I have yet to see one of them even smile.
Well, that goes with most of the jokes, except not from our listener.
Because, the listener
ladies
likes
and gentlemen,
the jokes.
This is the 300th episode of a thing that began in 2006. We've lasted 4 years doing this podcast every Thursday.
Six years.
It was my... Well, anyway, so yeah, 6 years of doing this, and it feels like four.
And to me, sometimes it really doesn't feel like many more than 4.5 to 5.
With good behavior. No, but I mean, I'm talking about each podcast feels like 4.5 to 5. But there are many listeners who have been with us from the beginning, and when we called out last, I know Ron's giving a strange face saying, I can't believe it, yet we printed out a whole bunch of great tributes, and we're going to read a bunch of them, and...
Okay, this one comes in from someone serving in the United States Navy who says, the formula keeps me glued to my work computer every Monday. This is when apparently it becomes available. In our facility, there are coworkers who also listen and bring their did you get the one where Ken or Ron said into every lab meeting. What kind of a lab would that be?
I don't know if it's a lab. It could have been a chihuahua, maybe. No, who wrote this?
Was from Ming Diaz of Great Mills, Maryland.
Well, I have one from Emma Hollister, who says, what I like most about the podcast are all the dorky political puns and jokes. They're usually the kind of terrible jokes that my dad would make. I really mean that in a good way. And they make me chuckle and groan in turns. I also love the predictions, right and especially wrong, since the latter means a rehashing of why exactly the world did not go as you anticipated. Thank you for all the chuckles and groans, the occasional stunned silence, and the full-on belly laugh. It's been a good first 300 episodes. And speaking of predictions, a lot of people, including Jack Goodman of Australia, he says he's been listening since podcast number one. He was so impressed with our call predicting Ned Lamont would defeat Joe Lieberman in the Democratic primary.
That was your call.
In 2006. And he said, of course, I was sadly misled. Until then, I had to wait for another 290 or so podcasts until Ron figured out the exact date when Rick Santorum would throw in the towel. At this rate, I'm guessing you guys will nail the 2018 midterm elections. Looking forward to that one. By the way, P.S., my wife hates your podcast, but then again, she's Australian.
That's all right. My wife hates the podcast, too, and she's not even Australian. My favorite moment is the overall theme of neutrality, writes Joseph Bowler from the town of Hotmail.
Why does that make me laugh?
Because it really is all politics. I'm a center-right American. That's a cliche, I know, writes Joseph. And the most legitimate news that I find in American politics outside the BBC comes from your podcast. Keep it up. If one of you passes away, we better have a weekly seance or at least haunt the studio. Back to you in Canberra.
And we have several from China. Alex Zwagerman, who writes from Changchun, China, says he's a devoted listener to the podcast. He lives in the People's Republic of China, where politics is much more opaque. It may surprise you that the It's All Politics podcast is almost never blocked, except for this one time when it turned out that Ken, I think, used the verb to Shanghai to express how a certain senator was forced to toe some party line.
You know, it's a good thing we didn't say that some politician had a type A personality.
Ooh, I like that very much. Anyway, Alex writes, I know it's not really a moment that you guys brought me, and the fact that I enjoyed that podcast has more to do with the ridiculous behavior of the Chinese censors, but it was my moment.
Eric Van Hove makes Ken's dreams come true by writing, I liked that time Ken told the joke about Abe Lincoln being Jewish. You know, Ray LaHood, by the way, represents a part of Illinois that's very close to the part of Illinois around Springfield that Abraham Lincoln represented in Congress back in the 1850s.
That's right.
And we just learned this week, by the way, something interesting about Abraham Lincoln's face.
He's on the $5 bill?
No, his face. He was asymmetrical.
He didn't like Jews? Actually, that's not true because he was shot in the temple. Oh, God.
I laughed hysterically. I'm sure it was just the three of us. I still laugh about it. I can't count the number of times I've retold that joke. And Eric, neither can I.
One thing I just want to say before we go is that Ron Elving brought in a beautiful cake today. On the cake for our celebration was the map of Arizona.
The shape of Arizona.
The shape of Arizona. And a little corner, it had the city of Yuma.
Yuma.
And
I think that will be meaningful to the listener. I also tried to find a picture of Abraham Lincoln in a temple and was not able to do so.
Who knew?
And let me also say that when you hear something like Herman Cain's voice saying 999, or when you hear music that concludes the podcast each week, that is the work of our producers and editors who have helped us on the podcast back over the last 6 years. Our current producer is Bracton Booker, and our current editor is Kathy Shaw. Others who have produced the program over the years include Evie Stone.
Well, Evie Stone certainly was magnificent in putting in the exact right music every time. We had Beth Donovan. We had Mathoni Muturi, who was, I think, our original editor. I think she came up with the theme music for It's All Politics.
And Giselle Grayson and Kimberly Adams. And that's it for this week's 300th political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for number 301 of It's All Politics from NPR.
I took my troubles down to Madam Ruth. You know that gypsy with the gold captive. She's got a hat on 34th and Vine, selling little bottles of love potion number 999.